So it's not like people didn't have these problems. I even see in my mother's generation, for example, where people did have problems. They just didn't have the awareness. There was no medical diagnosis for it. And it was commonly also believed somehow that if you also have a hormonal problem, having children would somehow cure you of it because your hormone would go through a reset, you know? So there was all of that conversation. It wasn't so much about you as a person and your health, but it was like, till you produce children, you know? And if you can produce children, then you're great. I think that was majorly the narrative. And I guess now that has changed where women have started really taking care of their own health and start taking things in their own hands.
Welcome to the fourth episode of the Ikivi Podcast Season 3. In this episode, we have with us Priyasha Saluja, a plant-based chef, entrepreneur, hormonal health coach, and founder of the Cinnamon Kitchen, a brand that champions delicious and nutritional products that are plant-based, gluten-free, and free of refined sugars. She also appeared in Season 3 of the Shark Tank India. In this episode, we speak with her about her journey from battling PCOS symptoms to founding the Cinnamon Kitchen, and how her personal struggles led her to embrace plant-based cooking and share her creations with others. She also talks about the interrelation between diet and conditions such as PCOS, insulin resistance, and others, and the importance of making conscious choices and seeing the value in hormonal health and sustainable lifestyle changes over quick fixes and diet fads. We hope you enjoy this lovely and insightful conversation. Okay, lovely. Thank you so much, Priyasha, for joining us. I am
Thank
so
you.
Excited to have you as part of the Ikivi podcast, season 3. We are very excited to hear from you, hear from your experience, hear from your story, and what led you to where you are today. My first question to you is about how this all began. How did the Cinnamon Kitchen begin? Would you like to share your story with us?
Sure, definitely. Thank you so much for having me. So the Cinnamon Kitchen really started as an Instagram page. At some point, you know, I mentioned this, I think most people kind of know about it, whoever heard me in the past, that I was diagnosed with PCOS when I was about 13 years old. So since I'd just been trying to find options that were good, that were healthy for me, and I was trying to experiment in my home kitchen, but that exploration was a bit limited by the fact that I was, you know, I had like exams going on, something or the other. I didn't also have access to a full kitchen by myself. But then that really changed when I went to Mumbai, where for the first time, I kind of started staying by myself. I had a whole house to myself. I had a kitchen. I was earning and I was leading that independent life, but also food was not really provided to me, right? Usually when you're living in Indian households, it's really easy. You know, you're given 3 meals, 5 if you will eat them, or 10, whatever you want, really, right? And so it was the first time that I was kind of feeding my own self, preparing food for my own self. How I started going about it was really trying to first order food. So I was trying to eat whatever, like, you know, I could find that went on for the first month where I was not sure what I wanted to eat. I was also like, okay, now Zomato, you know, like whatever, delivery apps are at my doorstep, all these restaurants are at my doorstep, I should eat, like, I should indulge, right? But then I realized that, you know, with the busy corporate lifestyle, when you're kind of sitting on your seat and you're indulging, it's really not good for you. So that went on for not too long, thankfully. It went on for like a month or two. And then I realized that I really need to change my ways. And then to change my ways, what I try to do is that I try to go to these supermarkets where I try to get something that was healthy, you know, that I could package food that was healthy, that I could sort of just get home, snack on, eat, you know, also have like some kind of meals. But then another time, because I really never purchased groceries for myself, I was like, okay, I'm going to the best of places to get my groceries. And I'm going to the healthy aisle. So the product is going to be great. You know, like there's no doubt about it. It's something that you would normally take for granted. But when I started, you know, sort of consuming these products, and as I got more familiar with how to buy, what to look for, what to not look for, I realized that a lot of these products, although on the shelf they said that it's healthy, it's sugar-free, it's gluten-free at the front and back, the back of the pack was full of emulsifiers, preservatives, additives. And I didn't really, come to realize that up until, again, I consumed it for a month or two and I was like, this is really not good for me. It didn't make me feel good. And then I left that also. And then I would just get raw materials at some point. Now, the raw materials that were available were thankfully you could choose good quality raw materials. And I went on to get these good raw materials and started preparing my own snacks, right? And when I did that, I realized that it was not so difficult to be able to do a meal prep. I was always inclined towards making food because I'd been doing a little bit of it since I was 13. But then, of course, when I had my own kitchen, I was getting my own groceries, I could do more of it. And so at some point, I was just doing so much meal prep for myself and I was posting all of that on my Instagram page. And when I was doing that, a lot of people said, listen, your Instagram looks like a food page and nothing else. Like, where are you? So then my friends were like, if you're really passionate about something like this, then maybe start a separate page that really talks about why you're doing what you're doing. And, you can post maybe the things that you're making because it seems also really unique. It doesn't seem like something that we also know of, right? So because of that, the Cinnamon Kitchen was really born, where I was just posting pictures of the things that I was making, documenting my journey, posting recipes, because the idea was to just put things out there. It was not driven by the purpose of like a business or anything. It was more like, okay, I'm doing it, I want to share something that I'm doing and benefit others as well.
Mm-hmm.
And then that's really how Cinnamon Kitchen began. And then later I saw that gap where I was like, people have the recipes, they don't still want to make it because they don't have access, they don't have time, they don't have inclination. Not everybody, I was so surprised that not everybody loves to be in the kitchen, right? I was like, what are you saying? So then I was like, fine, I'll make it for you. And then the kitchen started.
How lovely. Not everybody loves to be in the kitchen.
Yeah, really,
So to go back a little bit about PCOS in general, a lot of us have been, diagnosed with PCOS. It's something that has become really, really popular in terms of awareness amongst a lot of us nowadays. Can you draw some parallels and tell us a little bit about if you have this knowledge, of course, what about PCOS kind of, has recently come about? Why has it become such a problem currently or in our generation?
Yeah.
And also what that relates to food and how what we consume?
Sure. That's a very broad question and like a very valid one as well. It has several parts to it. The first part, which you said, is why has it become so popular? Like, why is it? I feel like the problem was always there. It was not talked about so much, right? Because first of all, I feel like this is something that I was also saying at a talk recently, is that anything that is to do with a woman's hormone health in a way that it disrupts a woman's fertility becomes such a topic of taboo, It becomes such a topic of also like shame where you can't openly talk about it. Like us as girls, young girls also, now I think there's change where everybody can say, listen, I got my period. Listen, like this is when I get my period or I'm having these problems, or even things like menstrual leave and things like that have started being discussed, Some 10, 15 years earlier, that was really not the case, right? Yeah. So it's not like people didn't have these problems. I even see in my mother's generation, for example, where people did have problems. They just didn't have the awareness. There was no medical diagnosis for it. And it was commonly also believed somehow that if you also have a hormonal problem, having children would somehow cure you of it because your hormone would go through a reset, So there was all of that conversation. It wasn't so much about you as a person and your health, but it was like, can you produce children, And if you can produce children, then you're great, But who are you but a vessel, So I think that was majorly the narrative. And I guess now that has changed where women have started really taking care of their own health and start taking things in their own health in their own hands, there's lesser shame around it. So there's more conversation. Having said that, of course, I wouldn't say that it's not increased a little bit. We have no statistics for that because really PCOS as a thing has only been started being covered and studied in the recent times, where even though people had PCOS, there's no study, there's no government study also that much about it. So you know, some say that like 1 in 5 women have PCOS, some say 1 in 4 is the statistic now, but the last study that was conducted on it was maybe like years and years ago, right? So there's no like, you don't know whether or not it's increasing, but yes, definitely lifestyle factors such as more exposure to food that has like a lot of preservatives, additives, more stressful lives, you know, the kind of foods that we consume or just like sleeping late, stress, all of those lifestyle factors have contributed to the worsening of health in general and also hormone health, right? Which again, I feel like people who can change it are changing, who have the access to the information. I feel like the whole conversation around holistic health has really come to the surface nowadays. So that's one part of your question where you said that, you know, why was it not talked about? The second part that you asked me was, you know, what are the foods that you can have, or what are the foods that contribute to PCOS, right?
My question is more about how does food have anything to do with PCOS?
Right, right. Okay. So, see, there's a lot of things. If you have, PCOS is inherently a hormonal imbalance and it is a lifestyle problem, right? Now, you can have it either genetically, where maybe your mother or your grandmother, somebody in your family has it and you kind of get it because of that. Or it can be a cause of lifestyle issues where maybe your testosterone is high, your insulin, there's insulin resistance, which has a cascading effect then on your hormones, which is resulting into PCOS, right? So everything that we experience in the human body is all sort of linked, right? Broadly speaking. So once you have a lifestyle issue and your body is already not, say, maybe uptaking carbohydrates that well, or a certain group of food that well, it's mostly like to do with carbohydrates and therefore insulin resistance. What happens is that it has a cascading effect on the rest of your hormones, including your thyroid hormones and such. And then everything just, you know, the harmony for everything just gets disrupted. And then that is what leads to PCOS and all other sort of lifestyle ailments, right? In modern medicine, what we really look at is one problem and then we look at the solution. So, you know, somebody would just like test you for markers. Say if you have PCOS, they'd be like, okay, your thyroid is more, your this is more, your that is more. And then they'll start treating you for those markers instead of analyzing and understanding the root of the problem. But because some things are already not working in your body, for example, you already have insulin resistance because your body is not digesting or uptaking your carbohydrates well or your sugars well. Now, in that case, when you are putting, say, a bread in your body or, you know, refined sugars in your body, what is happening is that your insulin, the uptake is not so good. And so there's like a huge spike and then a crash. So, which is stressing your pituitary glands out. And then that stress is releasing more hormones and then it's like disrupting the whole cycle, right? So that becomes a problem. And you're not realizing how your body is kind of getting stressed with that more and more and more, right? So you kind of have that fatigue as well internally. And that fatigue and stress leads to inflammation, which in turn contributes to PCOS.
So what are the typical foods that generally cause this imbalance or disruption in the system is carbohydrates and refined sugar and those kind of things? Is that what it is?
Yes. So it's different for everybody. You know, there's all of us are very different in terms of how we are processing food groups. So the broader thing that one can say is that it's seen in studies over and over that having sugar, refined sugar, because it has very high glycemic index, and 95% of people who have PCOS also have insulin resistance, right? So having sugars, having simple carbs, anything that your body can quickly digest and quickly have that insulin spike, and it doesn't, is not giving you sustained energy. That contributes to worsening your PCOS. And then dairy contributes to it because of the additional hormones that are injected. Also gluten, because the current grain of wheat that we have, one, it's like, you know, again, it leads to an insulin spike. That is one factor. And then the other thing is gluten, because the current seeds that we have for wheat for mass production is genetically modified. So once it's genetically modified, what's happened as a result of that is that the gluten in itself has become very strong. So if you look at wheat that was being produced earlier, which, you know, a lot of people say, give that argument that wheat is something that we've been eating for generations. So now, why is it a problem all of a sudden? It is because the seed is different. The way it's being produced is different. The pesticides that you're putting on it is very different from how you were cultivating it much earlier. So because that gluten strand has been so, it's become so strong, and now you're consuming that three times earlier, because we would eat according to the seasons, we had more variety in our food, we had more time to sort of, you know, where maybe if I talk about a typical Indian household, the woman in the family would typically stay in the family, she'd have more time to sort of cook us a variety of meals. All of that was possible. Now meals just become that you want to like fill your stomach up with something. So you're just, you know, you're just finding maybe one roti and sabzi and just like eating it, not caring so much about nutrition. So those are the kind of factors that have generally been seen, broadly speaking, to contribute to PCOS and worsening of its symptoms. However, it's also been seen that for some people, dairy is not causing any problem because their body has enough enzymes to be able to digest it. Whole gluten is not causing any problem. But then that is something that you need to figure out on your own. How you start treating it is elimination. You have to have an elimination protocol where you are getting rid of all food groups, seeing how that is working for you, introducing one, seeing how that's working for you. If it's not, then you permanently remove it, at least for the foreseeable future. And therefore, you figure out what works for you. Because there's no one size fit all. Everybody's bodies are really different.
Correct. Yeah, I really like that idea of just process of elimination, because, and the fact that we're all different, like, and not, we're not prescribing one particular diet for everybody because we're made so differently. I see so much value in that. How was your experience when you kind of were figuring this out for yourself, and when you were starting the Cinnamon Kitchen, how did that kind of play out for you in terms of how you felt in your body and how that kind of made you feel like this is something that you wanted to share?
Yeah. So I think this is when I was about 18, 19, around that age, where I really started eating. At some point, I just realized that whatever I was eating was producing so much heat in my body. And it was just like making me feel really uncomfortable and bloated, because most of it was just gluten and dairy, right? And so I read up a lot about it on the internet. I saw what's working for me, what's not working for me. And the first thing that I did was cut out carbs for breakfast. And that's something that I still do. I don't eat carbs for breakfast, no grains for breakfast. So I would typically eat, now it's become so much in the limelight where everybody's like has to start your food with protein and fats. And I don't know, maybe I read it somewhere. I don't clearly remember how that happened, if I'm being completely honest, but I clearly remember cutting out carbs from my breakfast and having things like maybe like some tofu or some eggs or, you know, whatever, like protein that I could get, some nice nut butter or something like that to start my day, some avocados. And that really, I think I saw a marked difference in terms of how my body was changing with that. And then I realized that having carbs, less carbs in general, I wouldn't say, you know, you go on a keto or you go on a radical diet, but I realized that having that sort of balanced approach to my meals was really helping me. Then dairy is another thing that I really cut out, and I replaced it because that information was widely available on the internet that they're putting so many hormones. And I was like, of course, there's no question that that's going to cause disruption in my hormones, right?
Yeah.
So I think then that was something that I cut out. Then I became vegan for very you know, more ethical reasons than, you know, diet-based PCOS reasons, which is something that I always tell people. I'm just like, if I've turned vegan, then you don't have to turn vegan because you want to do this. Like, even in workshops, people are like, you know, I want to turn vegan like you, and then I can, and I'm like, no, you know, maybe meat suits you, and maybe you don't have an ethical problem, and maybe you still want to reduce your consumption because that for you may be a more sustainable way of going about it. And you don't want to eliminate it altogether, right? Mm-hmm. But make sure that whatever sources you're having are quality sources, so they're actually contributing to you and not harming you. Because even chicken and stuff are injected with a lot of hormones, right? And so there's like a lot of lead in fish. So you kind of make sure that whatever you're getting is just good quality so that it's actually contributing to you. Sorry, what was your question? I just went in a flow.
No, my question was about how what your experience was like physically when you made the switch in terms of yes. your diet and started making more conscious choices in what you were eating and how that played a role in how you were feeling.
Right. So yeah, so it just reduced my bloating in general. I started losing weight easier, which was really a struggle for me. I used to go to gym every morning. I did that for like 3 months, 1 hour, you know, every day, grueling. Like, it's not good to like not then see any results, you know, like you stand on the scale, it's exactly the same. When you have so much inflammation, your body's not losing weight. So when I started incorporating these changes, I saw that even with, you know, like a more sustained sort of exercise routine, not stressing my body out, I could sort of figure, I could lose weight. Then I found martial arts, which I really love. And I started training in Muay Thai, and that really contributed to me feeling, me enjoying a sport and also benefiting from it. So I think it was a mix of the both, and then that it just became a lifestyle. And when it did become a lifestyle, and when I saw that because of this, my periods became regular, my, you know, like just generally the bloating and all was reducing, I really did think that it was something that carried immense value. Because at the age of 15, 16, when I had this diagnosis, I was prescribed thyroid medication, 100 mcg. At 16, 15. And then like insulin tablets and like, you know, after breakfast and dinner and you name it, like all kinds of things. And then, you know, like a diet of like just boiled soup and, you know, anybody, the kind of diet anybody would like shrivel up on. So I was given like that kind of thing, and because I refused to take any of that. And then I went on to this journey. I felt like, listen, now when I get my blood work done, everything is all right. And you were telling me to start those medications, which would have never left me for a lifetime since the age of 15, 16.
Yeah.
So because this has such immense power, why not share it, you know?
So these lifestyle choices and lifestyle changes is something that's crucial, right? That we kind of don't see enough value in. We're told in society to just like for a quick fix, just take that medication and be done with it. You'll feel better. Yeah. You'll move on with life. How does one actually start to make these lifestyle choices and changes? Because it can be overwhelming. It's something that you're not necessarily used to. You're used to the access of, you know, the Zomatos and Swiggies, and you're used to ordering food which comes to you in 5 minutes or 10 minutes or whatever, right? So, like, how does one actually make those conscious choices and see the value in hormonal health?
Right. That's a good question. I think now more than ever, it's really easy to eat healthy. The other day I saw Blinkit is now doing these salad boxes, which for us used to be literally like so much effort. It literally used to feel like I'm going to the khet and plucking it myself. You know, like you order it, it comes to you in like, you know, 3 days, whatnot. And, you know, the salad mixes. Now Blinkit is doing it. There's bottles for pre-seasoning and good ones, not your typical fried seasoning that's available. It's really easy, I think, and our consumers really have the power to be able to, I feel, shape the markets, right? It's such a powerful tool that when there is a demand, there is going to be somebody who's creating the products for you. So now I feel like even if you're ordering on Zomato and Swiggy, you can go and there is a healthy tab. And you can eat. In fact, like, you know, after I was doing my meal prep, and at some point, things did get very hectic for me at work when I was not able to do that meal prep. But at the time, there were a bunch of restaurants in Bombay that I used to order from all the time. But I used to just choose to eat better. So I used to order salads. I used to order green juices. You know, so I'm not saying that you have to sort of now become this person who doesn't have a social life and you are preparing meals for yourself and, you know, that's the only way of going about it. It's about being smart also about it, you know. Like, you know that if I get what I do now, I have a fairly busy life. So what I do now is I'll just order my salad box from Blinkit, for example. That box lasts me like 2 meals and I'll just simply order like a vinaigrette dressing or something. So what I have to do is I literally have to, and it's pre-washed, you know, I just have to like tear it, put it, I still wash it, so I put it in a salad spinner, but like you, and then you kind of carry your dressing with you, or you can even keep it in your office or wherever. You get the salad, you don't even have to chop anything, you just put some dressing on it, eat it, you have one salad that you've eaten, you know, in the day. So I feel like it's more about these small wins. For example, if you can do a no-carb breakfast where you can do a chia pudding, for example, like you can do a chia protein, which you can just prepare overnight. So if you have these little jars that you can have where you put your chia seeds, you put your protein powder, you put all of the things that you want to put one night before or even 3 hours before, you just pour some nut milk in it. And then that it's ready, you know. So it's not so difficult. Salad, you can, if these two things you can do, at least your 2 meals are sorted. Now you have one meal where you can even order and you can do like a protein or something like that, right? And you're good to go, really. Yeah. So it's not so much of an effort. You just have to get your basics right. And I think more often than not, the problem is the willingness. And also how our social circles are so centered around just, if you want to have fun, let's go drinking. But maybe if you want to have fun, you can go drinking sometimes, sure. But maybe if you want to have fun, do a class of aerial yoga with your girls, you know? So, I think it's just about choices.
Yeah.
Thank you for listening to the Ikivi podcast. If you are enjoying listening to our podcast, do consider supporting us by visiting www.ikivi.com. That is ikkivi.com. We are a small sustainable business supporting contemporary Indian brands. Our platform is run by an all-women team handpicking the most beautiful, ethically made clothes and accessories from across the country, all in one place. Our podcast is self-funded and will always be free to listen to. You supporting our work would mean a lot to us. Thank you for being here, and let's get back to our episode.
If some people are kind of, you know, earlier you mentioned that the ingredients that are mentioned behind a package is not necessarily, like, they claim to be healthy and all of that, but there are some kind of ingredients that are on there that don't necessarily work well for people. What are some of those, and how can us as laymen identify what those are and, you know, kind of say, okay, this has like added sugars, probably I'm going to avoid it, you know?
Yes.
What
I have actually a whole video on that on my Instagram page, and the highlights is one of the very first videos that I made where I was talking about, okay, this, look at this, it's the front of pack, and now look at this, what's saying. And then it also goes on to talk about the groups of foods that you should avoid. In general, if anything has OSE written at the end of it, then that's a form of sugar, even if it's not sugar. So, you know, you don't have to remember the bazillion names there are, but if you know the OSE, you know it's a form of sugar. So, if it doesn't say, and I think the broader rule is, don't buy anything for which the ingredients you can't pronounce. Like, you know, if it doesn't feel like food, it probably is not, you know?
Yeah.
So, and just read your back of pack. I also find it a good practice to compare nutrition between the two products of those two competitor brands and look at which has lesser sugar, which has more protein, you know, which has lesser carbs. Those are the markers that I would look at. And I would look at ingredients and be like, okay, does this, a layman should be able to understand it exactly. Like, you know, and then that's it. And now, thankfully, there are a lot of brands that are available where brands have made an effort to make things in a better way. And you don't have to go all that mile that we had to do, you know. You know, it's like I sound like back in my day, like my grandmother did this. But like, you know, like 3-4 years ago, not even that long ago. Well, we didn't really have a choice, but now there are a bazillion choices available. You just have to go looking out.
Yeah. So I wanted to talk a little bit about Indian cuisine and plant-based cooking and how that kind of is tied in together, and how we, of course, we do have ghee and paneer and all of those things that are not necessarily plant-based. But isn't an Indian cuisine very much focused on nutrition, taste? Like, isn't it a very wholesome kind of cuisine?
Yes. See, it is. It's definitely the easiest to be on a plant-based diet if you are, in fact, cooking Indian food. And the kind of knowledge also that we have of working with vegetables, I find that very fascinating. When you eat food in all other cultures, you realize that it's not such a common practice where we can make vegetables delicious, you know. Mm-hmm. So I feel like there's definitely so much to gain from that. Having said that, our diets really lack protein other than paneer. And they really lack, they are very rich in carbs.
Mm.
So what really would work is if you were to have those veggies, take the knowledge of how to spice up and, you know, do those veggies, but then you pair it with a protein source, be it your tofu, be it chicken if you eat like non-vegetarian, or a fish, or whatever you want to eat. If you want to eat a plant-based diet, then soy chunks is a good option. They say like genetically. So soy in India, first of all, I mean, they say it has estrogen. First of all, it's phytoestrogen, which is not digestible by the human body. Like, no studies have shown for it to be harmful. Also, it's a great source of protein. It's very lean. And in India, soy is also not genetically modified. So the news that we are getting is from other countries where soy is genetically modified, where the strain is again gotten stronger, and then that's a problem. Thankfully, in India, that's not the case. So any local good soy that you're getting is good for you here. You can eat it, mm-hmm. right? So tofu is a good source for plant-based, chickpeas, beans. But again, beans and chickpeas are also very high in carbs, and they also are very difficult for the body to digest. So I would exercise control while you're eating them. And then you also see what kind of works for you. But in general, I feel like also if you want to incorporate grains, then don't make it all roti. Incorporate other millets into your diet. So while having an Indian diet and while having something that's not all exotic and therefore like really expensive or the know-how of which you wouldn't know, you can change your Indian plate to look more balanced.
Mm-hmm.
A general way of following that is also the plating method, which is 50% of your plate should be vegetables. 25% of it should be a good source of protein. Some of it should be fat, right? Say like a 10% or an 8%, and then the rest of it can be some complex carbohydrate. Now that's a ballpark. Not every plate is going to look like that. So not every meal is going to look like that. You might just have only veggies and like a good salad in one meal. And then you might go on to like more carby something in one meal. That is also possible. But then just if you're able to picture that in your head and kind of go by that book, it's usually good.
What are your thoughts on, these mock meats and those kind of things that everybody seems to be talking about in a vegan diet, especially for the non-vegetarians that are converting to veganism? They do, like, in terms of taste and, you know, wanting of that meat and that texture and things like that. It is something that people are interested in. What are your thoughts on it in terms of the actual making of the product and how that has an impact on people?
So see, I feel that most of these, like even when we talk about Beyond Meat and stuff in the US, they are heavily processed. They will give you much inferior nutrient value as compared to meat. And they'll be a lot more processed, a lot more full of like saturated fats and stuff like that. Which are not good for you. So if you want to convert to veganism for ethical reasons and that's what you are planning to do, then you can maybe have it, but have it in moderation. You can see substitutes of soy that you can, you know, substitute with soy that are clean label and stuff that you can. There aren't those many widely available options on the thing. There is also this channel on YouTube called Avant-Garde Vegan. So now what that guy does is that he's turned to a plant-based diet and he's a chef. So he creates a lot of these mock meat options also that are made at home. So they're not like the typical processed meat. So if you want to make and keep something for yourself, you can also do that. There's a brand called Good Dot also that's doing it. I'm not sure of like how clean label and stuff they are. But if you're eating it, eat a little bit in moderation if you're really craving the taste. But I personally think that it's not a very sustainable way of eating because either you convert and you know, over time kind of train your palate to not want it, or maybe we'll just have to wait for much cleaner substitutes to be available in the market.
Yeah, because I also wonder about, you know, the amount of studies that are done on these kind of different diets and how that has an impact on the food that we eat.
Yeah.
Of course, like in terms of processed foods and packaged foods and all of that, we now are aware that it's causing a lot of damage. And that is a step that we should definitely take so that we can actually move towards a more healthier way of living. In terms of millets and the choices that you've made in terms of your ingredients for the Cinnamon Kitchen, I'd love to hear what your thoughts were on the actual products and making of those products and the choice of ingredients that you've chosen for the Cinnamon Kitchen.
So I feel, and what I felt during the research, I wouldn't say even research at the time, I was just making it for my own self, but is that most of our knowledge of baking comes from the West. So this whole trend of vegan, gluten-free, refined, sugar-free, like, trend is the wrong word, but like just full lifestyle and way of eating has really come from the West, even though of course in our Indian diets also a lot of things are just vegan, gluten-free. We just don't say it like that, right? Like, but these markers have been popularized more from the West, and I feel that they don't have access to millets, right? So how they would be preparing things would mostly be with oat flour or gluten-free refined flour, or maybe like rice flour at the max, right? Or quinoa flour. These are the bases that they were using. And then they were preparing the recipes based off of that. What I felt is that we have such a rich culture of millets within our country that, one, are able to grow in soil that's not of such superior quality. So, you know, don't require so much water also to grow. So, better for the environment. Also, they're naturally gluten-free. Also, they're very rich in, you know, a lot of these micronutrients and vitamins and minerals. So I felt like, so what I did was, I don't have as much of a Indian palate when I'm eating my food. Like, I thoroughly enjoy my Indian food and, you know, like I thoroughly enjoy eating a nice palak and chane and chole and all of that. But I can't do that like 3 meals a day, you know. So for me, I really craved more desserts and even savory things that suited like a more like wider world palate. And therefore what I did was that I took this knowledge of, you know, baking from the West, the base recipes. I incorporated the millets in it. Slowly I started understanding the properties of millets and what kind of millet would work for what. For example, amaranth has a really nutty flavor.
Mm-hmm.
And it's also self-binding. So because the gluten, there's no gluten, then the grains are not self-binding. You usually need like a starch to be able to structure it. So I understood that amaranth is sort of self-binding and it also has a very nutty taste. It also is very rich in calcium. So then I thought that if I add this nutty taste to chocolate, then the combination itself, now what it does, it actually enhances the taste of the chocolate itself. So it gives it a more deeper chocolatey flavor. Like ragi and chocolate also is a very popular combination that's been very popularized by a lot of people. Though personally, I find ragi to be too ragi heavy for it to complement chocolate. I feel like it's more of a contrast. So what I did was that I took these base recipes and these ideas and, like, you know, just from YouTube videos and such, I incorporated millets into it by understanding the properties of millets. And from there on, I kind of like went about to do more recipes and
Nice. Very cool. What are some of the products that you have currently at the Cinnamon Kitchen and where can people buy it? Can people buy your products internationally as well?
right now only in India, but we are working towards it. So the products are available on the website, on Amazon, on our website. The website is cinnamon.kitchen. Then it's available on Amazon. It's available on Blinkit. It's available in a bunch of, it's available on Limash in all over Delhi. Now we're also like listing with Zomato in several places. But if you are ordering on our website, which I would highly recommend, because you get access to a bigger, much bigger menu than you will at any of these retail stores. We usually do like a 2 to 3 day fulfillment pan India. So, and you will get like everything straight from our kitchen, you know. So, I highly recommend our website to order. And even Amazon, because they're essentially also doing the same thing. They're doing drop shipping from us. You know, they're not storing it. Because for me, I feel like, again, I want to give people really fresh food. So anybody who is doing drop shipping with me, I'm happier with them, because I'm just like, I will get it prepared just that day or one day before and send it out, rather than somebody keeping, storing it in their places and then sending it out. It's always better. What we were saying, other products. So I think the fudge is the bestseller, which has been widely popularized. Then the flourless cookies. I also love the vegan cheeses that we have. And we have this one oat-free granola, which is my favorite. It's got dehydrated, freeze-dried strawberries and bananas. And it's an amaranth puff granola with cacao nibs, which I really like. So I think those are my favorites. But there's also like a trial pack that you can get if you're new to us. And you can kind of sample out a variety of products from our menu through the trial pack. And then pick and choose your favorite and maybe order more of that the next time.
Lovely. My last question for you is about the business.
Yes.
You know, I mean, your appearance on Shark Tank must have been very, very exciting and thrilling.
Yes.
What has your business been like from when you started? How many years ago was that?
3 or 4 years ago, something like that. Yeah.
And how is it, end of
2019. Yeah.
And how has it been since then till now? If you can give us like an understanding of how the business has grown and pre-Shark Tank and also post-Shark Tank, I'd love to know.
Sure. So when I started, it was a bootstrap brand. It wasn't even a brand. It was like a home kitchen. I was like, fine, you know, you want to buy it, I'll give it to you. You know, like, so I got an oven and I'm like, yeah, now take the food, you know, like that was really the approach. I started with like 50,000 rupees. And I started around, I think, September of 2019, October, but like really towards the end. But I really wouldn't even call it starting at the time, because I was like just having fun and chilling and, you know, just like sending whatever people wanted. But at the time, I think I was able to do like some 30,000 rupees a month, 20,000 rupees a month. Then the next year, it went on to about like 1 lakh a month or 1.5 lakh a month. Then I think within the first year of 2019, say like within a year, I was like, okay, now this shit is getting out of hand. My mother's yelling at me. She's like, what is this? You know, this is now a halwai shop. You have to go out. And then I had to get another place. Then I got a smaller facility, which is like 1,000 square feet place, so that I get out of her, you know, sight. And then I started, I think there I could also get a few people to kind of help me out with things, because I was losing my mind with like just doing everything. And then because it's labor intensive, right? Like you're preparing batches.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah.
And so then at some point, like I think then I got people, and then within 6 months only, because I could get people and I could fulfill more orders, and I think the word was just spreading. For us, the customers have always been the biggest promoters of the brand itself, because they love the brand so much. They love the food so much and the commitment to the quality that they keep coming back and getting their friends also, you know. So the brand, like within, I think, 6 months of moving into that place, I was like, oh shit, I need to move again. And I was like, oh my God, I can't rest in peace. But then, I think from there, I moved to a bigger facility, which was a 2,500 square feet facility. And I was like, I don't know how I'm going to be able to get enough orders to be able to like manage this space, because it looks big, you know. And then, but actually within 6 months, 8 months, we also ran out of place there. And now currently we're It's like a 5,000 square feet facility, which again, I have to move from. Oh my God. But we actually like didn't move this time. I just got another floor within the same factory. But like I'm going to have to move again from here because we're also out of place here.
Wow.
And we're currently at about like 42 people. So you were asking about like before and after. So from starting from like 50,000 right now, we're doing about 1 crore a month, something like that. So it just, before Shark Tank also, we were doing about 50. So the sale has kind of like doubled. Wow. But also what's been really remarkable is not so much the spike. Of course, the spike's been nice. But, it's been the access and the, like the word spreading.
Yeah.
I think that the platform in itself just enables you to reach out to so many more people, which as a brand owner, as a small brand owner, you're not usually, like, we've not really spent in marketing, right? Because other things took priority. And so for having that access for the brand to be shared on national television with so many people is a huge thing. And then the avenue that it opens up for you, because as a small brand business owner, people don't trust you as much. Like bigger retailers will not trust you as much. So the credibility it gives the brand that now it's come here, there's a promise, it's approved by, you know, fellow investors and this and that. So then that opens up avenues for you that you never could imagine. So
yeah.
which I think is more the long term benefit than just a spike in sales, because that I feel like can still come and go if you're not able to. You might retain some customers, but you need to be able to again provide really quality products and also make the most out of the access that you get to be able to spread your brand.
Yeah. I have one more question. Sorry.
So,
during COVID, we had a lot of home chefs come about, and there's so many quality products and so many different cuisines also kind of coming into the picture because people don't need a restaurant set up to start and sell things.
Right.
Do you have any advice for these home chefs to kind of keep going and actually reach more people?
Yeah. So I think one of the things that I did right when I started off was understanding that my product is great, okay, but I also need to know, I mean, if I'm to really expand, then my product's probably 30% of what I'm doing overall. So it's also very important for me to give the customer an experience there that they come back for, you know? So to be able to understand that, to be able to not just work on the product, but also the entire sort of supply chain of what you are doing, to be able to figure more marketing avenues. Maybe, you know, you do a farmer's market, maybe how you can supply to like other retailers, or you can expand reach. That also, figuring out your pricing is very important, because as home chefs, people are very dedicated to the product and they want to use the best product, which is great. But they most times don't think of the overhead that may come their way once they expand. So what happens is that they are maybe producing something for 100 rupees and selling it for 200 rupees, thinking that, listen, I am making some money off of it. But right now, they don't have overheads like, say, their electricity is being paid at home, or it's like not commercial electricity, or they're not paying for the space really. They don't have these kind of overheads. So they're like, okay, this much I earn, all of it is my profit. But when you expand, that's not how it works. You have to take in account the marketing cost, you take in account the packaging costs, the logistics, or, you know, even like longer term, whatever charges there are, which are bazillion and keep increasing and keep growing in size. So, I think just having a basic knowledge of that, and sort of also being a bit grounded about understanding that your product might be great, but there are a lot of other factors that you need to get right to make it work, is very important. And, you know, this is something that I've figured, because I also teach, and I've been teaching for the past 2 years, 2.5 years. And so I also teach baking, but I also teach the business of baking. So how, you know, if as a home chef or the licenses, what are the things that you need to get, this and that. So once I teach that kind of stuff, I realize how many people I thought that it was basic to understand pricing and this and that, because I came from a commerce background. Not their fault, like I came from a commerce background and then I went on to food. But for most chefs who just like, you know, who know the art and, you know, really want to do something about the art, it's not as common knowledge to them.
Yes.
So, yeah. So I think just figuring these kind of things, I mean, you can buy my workshop, but you can also Google it. And you will have all the information that you want available to you. It will take you more time, but and it will be tedious. But I just clubbed it all together.
Yeah.
I mean, whatever route you go, but just make informed decisions about your business.
Yeah. I love that. Thank you so much, Priyasha, for joining us today. Such a lovely conversation.
If you enjoyed this conversation, don't forget to subscribe to the Ikibi podcast, a space for discussion on living meaningful and fuller lives each day. The Ikibi podcast is a property edited and produced by the team at Ikibi.